Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
Hello, everybody. This is IGN UK podcast number 428.
I thought we don't name them, number them.
Gav says that, but like, you know.
Oh, is that just one of Gav's things?
I'm into taxonomy.
Well, he's away as well. When Gav's away.
Well, it's useful, but you probably already know that because you download it and we put it on the metadata for the app. Hello, I'm Daniel Krupa, and this is Joe Screbbles.
Hello, that's me.
Look at this, a little two-man podcast.
Yes, very unusual, isn't it?
Just so, you know. Full disclosure, the reason we're doing this is it's after hours. There is actually a lot of top secret stuff going on this week.
I mean, when we say after hours, we should always do this.
We've got two Ronies on the go.
Ronies for days.
Yeah, there's lots of very, like, secret trips going on this week. Well, there's one not-so-secret trip. Gav's just on holiday in Hawaii having the best time of his life.
Putting it all on Instagram.
It's very good.
And I mean all.
It's very good. You should follow him on the socials if you don't. That massive influx of followers you just got.
Unbelievable.
But also, we've got some secret trips going on this week, which we can't talk about for 3 weeks, but when we do.
As someone who's not on any of them, I can tell you, I'm jealous. Yeah. It's amazing. We've got some good stuff happening.
We're going to go see something amazing this week. But we'll talk about that in probably 3 weeks' time, I think. But what we're going to be talking about today is we've got a really... So the second half of this podcast, when you get to it, is a really fascinating chat that I recorded earlier today with Andy Nyman and Jeremy Dyson, who are the writers and directors of a new British horror movie called Ghost Stories, which is out on April 6th. And, like, I say this in the interview... And the interview is a little bit embarrassing because it's like when we interviewed Jeff Kaplan and I become a little bit of a fanboy, so you can all enjoy that. But I really love the horror movie and it's a really great British horror movie.
It's fantastic.
So we'll get onto the layer and we'll talk about that a bit in more detail. But that's the second half of this podcast. First, we're going to talk about another movie that is out this week called Ready Player One.
What?
And this is like... It's a thing that's like dominated a lot of conversations in the office and on the podcast for like months and months. And a lot of them have been fairly negative or cynical or reserved.
As I saw from the IGN UK feedback for 1 or 2 weeks, a lot of people disagreed with my opinion that Ready Player One looked fundamentally embarrassing.
But also, like, I think we kind of had this conversation in the pub, like, after Black Panther. 100%. We were, like, having this. And, like, it's one of those things where I think sometimes we have conversations, and, you know, you're kind of playing devil's advocate as well. You're taking a stance to press it to the extreme.
Mm.
And so I've seen it. You haven't.
Yes.
And I texted you immediately. I went to see it on my day off. Yeah. And I texted you after. And I just need to say, like... I went on my day off and I thought, oh, I do want to see it just to see what it's all about, whether our assumptions about it were right or wrong. And I wasn't like massively looking forward to it. I went in, I sat down. First 10 minutes, I thought, okay. And then after 15 minutes, I was like, I was so into it. I was having such a brilliant time.
Yeah. And this is
it's just great fun.
This is what I'm hearing from everyone. And to the gloating listeners, continue gloating. It sounds like I was completely wrong. This is a good Spielberg film. Like,
yeah,
it does... it doesn't indulge in the stuff that I was worried it was going to.
And like, it's a weird thing, and we're very fortunate. Like, we get to speak to like filmmakers, and you know, the marketing team almost exclusively handle posters and trailers. And the most distinctive thing about this movie is the fact that it has all this pop culture stuff in it. Like, it's got all this shit in it. And you would emphasize that in trailers because it makes it look different to everything out there. So, and also, it's like, oh, you like this thing. You like this thing. That's in this thing.
And that's what annoys me about it, because it feels like there's no substance, which it sounds like I'm wrong about.
Yeah, but then when you got into it, when you get into it, that stuff is there, obviously. Of course it's there. And it's there all the time. But it's like kind of like payoff, punchline. But most of the time, it's kind of background texture for this like story about someone who's trying to beat a video game. Like, essentially, a big video game quest.
So it sounds like the good bit of Wreck-It Ralph. First 20 minutes.
Yeah, it is. And then like, I watched the Spielberg documentary, the HBO documentary, when I was flying to Montreal a few weeks ago. And there's a really good line in it, because Spielberg, though, he never went to the same film schools as all the other guys. He's like part of Scorsese and De Palma and Lucas, like the brats that changed Hollywood. And in that documentary, the thing they say about Spielberg, the recurring thing, is even though they maybe made more acclaimed movies, more serious movies, he was the successful one. The thing they say about him is like, the thing you've got to remember about Steven is he's a fucking nerd.
Yeah.
And you watch this movie and he's like, he is a fucking nerd.
Yeah.
And there's lots of talk about like how there's never been a great video game adaptation. I think this is one of the movies that really understands why you would like to play a video game and what's cool about video games. And it talks about a lot of video game concepts. Doesn't like labor them. It just assumes that you might know what they are.
Yes.
And talks about it. Like, when you see the trailer and all these people are dressed up with all this shit and you're like, oh, there's all these characters in it. But when you're in it, you realize that the way the Oasis works is permadeath is a thing. And
It's Eve Online.
When you're playing, you accumulate what they call coin, and you can use that to buy upgrades and skins and stuff. So when you see someone in the Oasis that looks like Tracer, they've bought that skin.
Yeah.
And it's literally what we do. We hoard money on Overwatch so we can buy cool skins. And that's what the threat is. So when I first saw it, I was like, oh, it's Iron Giant turns up in a weird, like, intertextual way. No, it's someone in the game is saving up to buy Iron Giant.
Well, this is an interesting point because, again, one of the fundamental problems with video game movies is that they're going to have to boringly and patronizingly explain what a video game is and what it does. And I think, to be fair, the section about explaining what an Easter egg is in the trailers is ham-fisted as hell in a way that really irritated me and felt exemplified by the rest of the trailer. But you sent me a text, and I've read this from multiple people who I think are actual good thinkers, that the way it introduces actual video game concepts feels satisfying and rewarding, I guess, to someone who plays them. So you were talking about, you know what, now that I think about it, I can't remember anything you talked about, but some really interesting stuff.
There's also things just layered in there, like
pay to win, you were talking about.
Pay to win's in there, and like being part of a clan is a thing in there. But none of them like dominate as major plot points, but they all like fuse together to be part of the narrative.
And no one's sitting there going, we're in a clan, we have to name our clan, and these are my friends in the clan.
With things like this, it's really hard to detach. If you listen to the podcast, you're like, I assume you're really into video game culture. So it's kind of hard when mainstream media tackles this thing they almost universally shun.
Yes.
So for the first time hearing, there's a section in it where they mention GoldenEye, and like, there's a way that you could find it a bit cringe. And I felt, when I was listening to it, I felt myself slightly cringing, but I was like, actually, this does sound authentic. It just feels weird to have it spoken, let alone spoken in a massive Hollywood movie.
Because
they talk about having slappers only. And it's like, that's a proper GoldenEye thing. Good. But it's just weird to hear it in a big movie. And the same like someone saying like, oh, I watch her Twitch streams. Like, I'm not of the generation that watches loads of Twitch streams. But like, I recognize that that is a thing people say.
Also, can we just point out,
it feels weird.
In Ready Player One time, is Twitch going to be around?
Could be, mate.
I mean, they better could be diversify.
Could be old stuff.
Could be. I watched her Twitch streams.
In the movie,
she's dead
talk
now.
About walkthroughs, and like wikis and stuff. Like there's all this stuff like going around, and there's a big evil corporation that wants to like win the Easter egg hunt so they can own the Oasis. Mm. And the thing they want to do is like big evil publisher. They want to fill it with full of microtransactions and ad space.
Right.
So everything gets advertised in the Oasis. Yeah. So there's like this weird net neutrality, like anti-advertising strain in it. But again, it's just there in the background. And if you know what that stuff is, you're like, ah, cool.
Have you ever read Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson?
No.
Firstly, incredible, one of my favourite ever books, and presaged The Matrix in a load of ways. But that has a very similar thing where it's sort of the, it's the point after which virtual reality has been taken over by corporations. And it's fascinating. Like the way that a guy, I think it was 1994, like the way this guy, Neal Stephenson, was talking about how companies would take over a virtual space is bang on with that kind of stuff. And also, like, mad, I'm going off on a tangent, but he did mad things like, he essentially predicted what Google Earth was going to be and stuff like this, like really weird specific visions of how this all works. But that's what excites me about Ready Player One, having had you tell me about it, this idea that it's not necessarily about the sort of adventure and like the pop cultural elements of it. It's the idea of how do you transplant what we have into a situation two, three steps beyond.
Yeah, like the main thing is like this Willy Wonka figure has set up this Easter egg hunt within this game he's built. And it's on to people to like appreciate and look for clues. And obviously, if you are versed in pop culture, particularly of the 80s and 90s when James Halliday grew up, you'll have an advantage. So there's lots of scholars who study pop culture of that age. Mm. So it's quite cool. There's like scenes in labs where people are like studying X-Men comics on big screens. Like they're weird, like Egyptian, fresco isn't the right word for an Egyptian, but like a weird kind of like hieroglyphics. They're like studying them like for
clues. How far in the future is this meant to be?
It's like 2049 or something. It's like Blade Runner time.
That seems mad. Why would they be studying them that way?
No, they're studying them because they're looking for clues to solve his...
Oh, sorry, right.
Sorry, like, yes. This is... Because he's issued this challenge. For years, this kind of subculture has arisen around, like... Well, because obviously, if you solve the quest, you inherit the Oasis, so trillions of pounds worth of business. So people have become pop culture scholars.
Mm.
But again, a lot of that stuff is incidental to the main narrative, which is trying to find three keys to unlock a prize.
So I've heard...
Like, it's very simple in one sense.
I've heard lots of stuff about, like, why it works and what it does well with the sort of pop cultural stuff it's going for. Why is it a good Spielberg movie? Like, what Spielberg added to that?
What's he added to it?
Like, is it... Has it got the sort of childish heart of a lot of his stuff?
It is or childish is heart, it... I think... There's a group of five kids who play together who are the central
thing. That's basically Spielberg, isn't it?
And yeah, it's the five kids from, you know, it's the kids from E.T. and they're like the clan that emerges through the game. They're in a co-op session and they win the challenge together.
That doesn't sound
sorry.
Good. What?
Yeah, and it's just got, going back to the documentary, like he knows how to visualize a story. There's amazing stuff when he puts on the VR headset, the camera moves in a way that you then slip into the headset with him. And it's just like orchestrating all those visuals. Because obviously there are sequences where it's just insane the amount of stuff that's on screen. I would say a lot of that all went into the trailers. So it looks constantly hectic.
Mm.
It isn't always like that. There are busy scenes. But I just think being able to like orchestrate all that stuff. Also, he's probably the only director who could get away with some of the stuff that movie does because it plays with other directors' stuff.
Oh, okay,
In a way that if a lesser director did it, it would seem sacrilegious.
Yes.
Whereas Steven Spielberg does it, it's like,
Who's above Spielberg?
Because he's like gone into the toy shop and he's playing with anything he wants.
Yeah.
And I feel like if you gave that to like a new time director, it'd be like, have you done that? Oh, you were actually friends with him.
Did you see
Did
you see the brilliant story about Zach Penn?
Huh?
So Zach Penn's the guy who wrote the who adapted the screenplay, and he wrote Last Action Hero. And so when he went and saw the movie, there's a bit where Ty Sheridan, isn't it? His character's driving down a road, and he passes a cinema, and the cinema's showing like Last Action Hero 3 or something. And Zach Penn didn't know that was going to be in there, and had sort of said, I don't want to include any of my own stuff in there. And Spielberg had put it in on purpose with, is it Ernest Cline?
Yeah. Who's the
those two had collaborated to be like, let's put in a little surprise for Zach. And you're like, that's so lovely. What a nice thing. Like, I mean, obviously, super high privilege Hollywood version of doing a nice thing for someone, but really cool.
Very, very nice.
Yeah.
And there's like, yeah, I feel like not only does he just obviously... Joe, I'm just going to say it. Spielberg, he's one to watch.
What?
He's one to watch, like, for the future.
I'm not convinced.
I'm just going to give him a little tip for everyone listening. He's one to watch. Yeah, it's really good fun. I don't want to, like, big up too much because I think the expectations of that movie are all over the place. But, like, I went in not expecting much and, like, people have been a bit down on it. I just thought it was just a load of fun. And I thought it really got... You get through all the kind of like busy texture of it and like, oh, there's that thing from that thing. It's really fun, like escapism.
I have to say, I've not seen
anyone... That sounds like a bottle out. It's like fun escapism. I know that's sometimes a play to like shitty movies to like justify
them. I love fun escapism.
But like, I just really got caught up in it.
Mate, I watched Game Over Man by the way.
Ben Mendelsohn is a brilliant villain.
He's amazing.
Because like, he's a really good Spielberg villain because he's like this weird petty villain.
Yeah,
he's not like super maniacal.
Childish.
Yeah,
he loves that.
Well, it's like,
he's a bully.
Because like, there's a weird thing with Mark Rylance is the guy who invents the Oasis. You've seen, like great Shakespearean actor, great theatre actor. He's in Dunkirk as well. Simon Pegg is like if he is Steve Jobs, Simon Pegg is his like was.
Oh, really?
And Ben Mendelsohn like worked with them. So there's this weird flashbacks to like Silicon Valley era.
He's one of those guys who sold all his, who didn't, sold the shares before they became big.
Yeah, so there's this weird flashback where it's kind of like almost like Jobs the movie or something where it's like Silicon Valley and they're developing the Oasis and these cool flashbacks to those moments. So all that stuff is never in the trailers because they want to show you like Chun-Li and Tracer and stuff. There's like cool stuff like that in it as well.
That's fun.
Anyway.
I'm looking forward to seeing it and I'm assuming now that I'm going to like it, but I will let you know if I think it's shite.
That's always the thing when you see something early and you're like an advocate for it. I think anyone feels like that.
Oh, of course, yeah.
But yeah, I had a lot of fun watching it.
We're going to do that later on.
Here's another movie that we both saw that we really liked. Well, I loved it.
I think it's absolutely fantastic.
So, Ghost Story. So, in a while, we're going to hand over to me, speaking to Andy Nyman and Jeremy Dyson in detail about the movie. But we talk about a lot of stuff. We talk about, like, old horror movies and, like, approaches to making movies in Britain today. But we don't actually talk much about what the movie is. So, we're going to set it up right now. And it's a movie that is based on a play they wrote a few years ago. It played in Hammersmith and they went to London's West End for a few years.
I'm sure you and Gav have talked about it a few times on the podcast.
And what it is, it's kind of like a portmanteau horror movie. So that is mini narratives with a framing narrative bringing them all together. In the case of Ghost Stories, it's a paranormal investigator, lecturer, who investigates three mysteries to prove whether they're real or not. And then he gets, you know, it hands off to these little insect.
And he's
movies.
A committed skeptic, we should
he's
point out.
He's a committed skeptic. And they've adapted it for film. And, like, these are two guys who've, like, flirted with horror throughout their careers and stuff. Jeremy Dyson with The League of Gentlemen, Andy Nyman worked a lot with Derren Brown, but it's been horror movies and horror TV shows.
And Derren Brown's played with the idea of horror in his shows forever.
And it just feels like, you know, if you've loved the thing for like 40 years of your life and then you get the opportunity to make it, you just like go nuts. Like you have all these ideas like been percolating for 40 years and then speaking to them, you're about here. Like it's obviously they're just like super happy they got a chance to make it.
Yeah.
And it is like, it's such an elegant horror movie, I think.
And this is the hard thing is it plays with this idea of the anthology series that we've seen so much recently. To the point where I don't want to say what any of the stories
are. No, I don't think so. Like,
which is really hard because then you're just going, trust us, it's a fun movie with different stories inside. But I cannot impress upon you enough how, A, surprising those stories are in taken together because I can say at least one of them's fucking horrible, one of them's funny.
Very, very.
And one of them is, like, confusing and undermining, and it has this sense of they're not just playing with you by going, oh, there's different horror movies in this. They're playing with you by going, you won't know how to feel from scene to scene because you never know whether you're being played for a laugh.
You don't know what the coordinates are.
Yeah. It's like the film itself is interacting back with you because you're going, fuck, and then there's a laugh and then you're like, oh, I feel a bit more chilled out, and then it's like, fuck again, and it just constantly unsettles you in a really exciting way. The first story of the three made me feel profoundly unpleasant.
Yeah. I think they're all great in different ways. And there's like nice little variations in tone. There's only three inset narratives in this one, whereas like some of the older horror movies, they try to cram in more. But this three is nice. And also the framing narrative becomes a bigger thing in the movie. And I think it's just such an elegant movie because there's this really great quote by Stephen King. And I'm going to paraphrase it badly, but it's something like, there's this division of horror as he sees it. And one is like the best effect that you can achieve as a horror writer is terror. And that is like Anne Radcliffe. It's like fear of the sublime is terror. So if I'm doing my job, if I'm having a great day, I'll terrorize you. If I can't terrorize you, I'll horrify you. So I'll show you a spider.
Yeah.
Something like that will make you feel on edge. If I can't horrify you, I'm not a proud man. I'll gross you out.
Yeah.
I'll show you something disgusting. And I think this movie has that full range. I think mainly it's in the mode of like terror. So it's the fear of like the spectral. It's the suggested. I think that's
the overall.
Well, I think
effect.
It's much more like it is ghost. So it is more ghostly than it is like visceral horror.
Yes. But then, yeah, no, that's fair. Yeah,
and
yeah.
But then I think sometimes it steps down and goes, we'll show you just something freaky.
Yeah.
And then occasionally it'll go, we're going to do something bonkers.
But then, yeah, but that's what I love.
I love that change of register.
It abandons the gross out element. Like, there's very little in there where you're like, oh, that's gross.
There's a couple of things that are a bit gnarly.
What it skips
like
to is
lines.
You just go, what the fuck is that? And, like, you laugh because particularly one of the stories is designed to make you go, are you kidding me? Like, what is this?
Yeah.
And then you get no explanation, and that's the delight of it, because you're just sat there going, I don't know what I'm meant to think this is. It's also, Ghost Stories is super satisfying if you love British TV as well. The kind of key actors in it, Nyman aside, who's great, but he's not known for the same stuff.
No.
But Paul Whitehouse is a major character. Alex Lawther from Black Mirror.
Brilliant.
I think Alex Lawther is my favourite actor at the moment. Everything he's in, I just go, he's amazing. You'll probably know him best from End of the Fucking World. Third one, Martin Freeman. You've got these people who you're not used to seeing in this context.
Yeah.
Doing some of their best work, as far as I'm concerned.
Martin Freeman's great.
I think Paul Whitehouse,
it's kind of like a weird revelation seeing him doing something like that.
We've talked about this before. Paul Whitehouse, I grew up with going, he's one of my favourite comedians, he's a funny face. To see him scared is almost like seeing a friend or a parent scared. It has this weird effect where you're like, it doesn't work to see someone you love for that reason in this role. And it just pushes the effect so much further because you're like, oh, I really don't want Paul Whitehouse to have a bad time. I love him. It's really cool.
There's this weird thing. I don't really talk to them about it, but like, I'm a huge League of Gentlemen fan. I've talked about it on the podcast many times, and like, there's this weird thing where all these people who kind of know each other, this like little coterie of friends who were like horror nerds when they were growing up, have obviously got into this position where they can like get stuff made, and they're doing it in really interesting ways. Like, whether it's like 10 years ago, Mark Gatiss wrote an anthology thing for BBC One and BBC Two called Crooked House, and Derren Brown's in that and stuff, and that's an anthology horror movie for TV. You know, Rishi Smith and Steve Pemberton making Inside Number 9.
Amazing.
They're doing this. It's like these little horror nerds get to like make stuff now.
And they're all so good at it.
Well, they just like really understand and appreciate genre in a really knowledgeable way and a really enthusiastic way. And like, as you're about to hear, I think it really comes across, like doing this job for like many years, you speak to people about projects, and it's obvious when like a project that's gone on for long, whether they care about it. I've spoken to people who've been on high profile projects. You can tell they do not care about it whatsoever.
Yeah.
It came very obvious, and you'll be able to hear, that they are very proud about what they made, and they made a thing on their own terms, a thing they love. And like, I just want to like, I hope people go see it, because it'd be really cool if they get to make more of these things.
Oh, mate. I'm
if you made one of these like every like 3 years for the next like 10 years, like in a great amicus tradition or Hammer tradition where you get different British TV actors to be in it.
And I'm like, not cool like enough to go like, oh, they could be doing so much better. Just keep making this, please. I love it so much. Just this like condensed, self-contained idea of like, we're just going to throw something at you and that's it. And you get nothing else. And you just go, brilliant. It works in that, as you said, it comes from a play background. It works like a play. You know that there's nothing to come later.
Yeah.
There's no franchise being built around it. It's just there.
Well, it's just like a really good appreciation of genre and like understanding that these are the coordinates of this thing you're going to unfold. And you can just tell the people who made it have like spent a long time appreciating this stuff and suddenly got the opportunity to make a thing and they've absolutely nailed it. So yeah, I'm going to hand over to the interview where, yeah, I'm going to apologize towards the end of it. I get a little bit fanboyish and you can hear me giggle, but yeah, it's very good. You should go see it so they can make more of it.
Enjoy.
So I saw the play twice. I saw it at Hammersmith and I saw it when it transferred. How did you go from it being a stage play to it becoming a movie?
Well, it was a long process. You know, because when we were first writing it as a play in the first week of actually sitting down to write it, we smelt that it had cinematic potential. But we were kind of disciplined about saying yes, but we're doing a play, so you know, we parked it, and then there was a gradual creep towards the idea of doing it. And first, there was interest from other parties, which we turned down for various reasons. But we came to the conclusion over time that if we were going to do it, we wanted to make it ourselves, not just write a script and hand it over to someone else.
And when Jeremy says other parties, I think it is important to state that they were sort of, one was a proper sort of Hollywood offer and another was a wonderful American independent. But it was when we dug into what we wanted, aside from we felt we'd have more creative control doing it a different way, the Britishness of it is what we didn't want to let go of. And we felt that
because, you know, we both had a memory of, we were going to see Hellraiser the weekend it opened and as young men, and also it was the weekend they started Chicken McNuggets.
I remember, well, that, I remember, yes, that.
But they but being
they give them out as freebies, that's why
that it was
farewell
such
to
a
the flesh.
it was such a quintessentially British film, and they'd had to compromise by putting American hats on the policeman and having, yeah, the policeman speak in American, because obviously those, then it was a compromise in order to get it financed, right. And it seems such a silly, trivial thing, but it was so important to us to make it as the kind of film that, well, we grew up with.
It's more unsettling that it takes place in that suburban house in North London.
Well, yeah. Hellraiser. Yeah.
What are the challenges of taking it from the stage to the screen? Because obviously this is like a portmanteau horror movie. You know, it's three individual stories with a framing narrative. And on stage, the framing narrative is more distinct, whereas here you play the lead character and, yeah, you become much more embroiled in the individual stories.
Well, it was really interesting because it's a really difficult thing unpicking it and putting it back together again. And I remember we'd had quite a few conversations about it, Jeremy and I, and he was talking about, I remember really clearly you telling me about something you'd read with Milos Forman and Peter Schaffer when they were doing Amadeus, and Forman saying to him, you have to start again, you know, just thinking, why? This thing is perfect. Why would you start again? Not us about ghost stories, you know. But it's so true, because in some respects we really had to unpick it and pull it apart, because the play it's so deeply theatrical. And that was one of the exciting things, I think, for us and for an audience, was that you were seeing things you would only really see in a horror film, but on stage, with deeply theatrical, old-fashioned sort of theatrical techniques. Well, you couldn't replicate. And also, the thing is based around a lecture on the stage where you as an audience are involved in the moment in that lecture. Well, you can't replicate that on film. And it took us right until almost the end of the edit to throw away that device, because there was still more of that.
It was
the
a
film.
Discovery, you know, the film has a different centre to the stage play, but it wasn't contrived. We had to find what that shift was by doing it. You know, obviously there was some obvious mechanical stuff that you have to do. Not, you know, as Andy's already said, with the framing narrative, but, you know, also with how you're going to stage it. And so I guess we focused on the practical tasks, and then, you know, that more esoteric one of, well, what is it, was found in the doing of it. Yeah.
This is the first like horror movie you directed. But throughout your careers, it's obvious that you have a debt to the horror genre and have played with it in various ways. Because of this opportunity, was it a great like opportunity to do all the things that you've wanted to do, that you've admired, that you've studied and kind of collected and go, oh, this is the opportunity to like bring it together? And
I'd say for me, I mean, I don't know about Andy, but for me, absolutely that, you know, it was, that was the most thrilling and exciting thing. It was like, you'd been working all your life for this, for this moment. Funnily enough, one of the first sort of things I wrote was a book called Bright Darkness, which is, an appreciation of supernatural horror films. And, you know, that came out 20 years ago. And I picked it up not so long ago because someone was inquiring about republishing it. And although there was much that I was ashamed of in it because it was a pompous young man's book, what was interesting was there was an element of it that was like a manifesto for, you know, for this job of, because all the things that I'd loved in other films,
this is The Haunting.
And
Dead of Night.
And there's Val Luton films from the 40s, Cat People and I Walk with a Zombie. And, you know, and the other British films from the 60s and 70s, the Amicus films in particular. You know, they all found their way into ghost stories. And it was an absolute celebration of, for me, that love of it. But it was also, it was a shared love.
Identical. Yeah. I mean, we've been friends since we were 15. And part of our shared experience and friendship has been horror films. You know, our first proper weekend together after we met at summer camp was going and renting The Exterminator and The Beyond. You know, and phoning each other when Starburst had come out. And go, oh my God, have you read Alan Jones's? Listen, what's happened? You know, I mean, that's our excitement of that. So when we wrote the play,
I'm still waiting for the 3D Little Shop of Horrors.
We should ask him when we see him. When we wrote the play, we literally wrote the play that we would want to see when we were 15 / now, which is we're virtually identical aside from the fact we've both got families now. Other than that, it's the same. And that was the same with the film, because sort of therein lies madness. Otherwise, trying to what we knew we didn't want to do was make something that felt generic or felt like
felt compromised
or a product. Because there's plenty of that, and that you understand why. Because if people are spending X million dollars, they want to try and ensure that it will appeal to as many people as possible. So of course that's going to be the case. But where we were blessed with fantastic collaborators in Warp Films and Lionsgate, Screen Yorkshire, and I mean it has honestly been amazing.
We've been very well supported by, you know, all those people just wanted to enable us to make this film.
To make what we wanted to make. And so literally we wrote the film that we would want to see. And so that means that that means you're on a knife edge as well, of course, because a lot of it may not work for people, because a lot of it is out there. But then they're also the things, when we talk about films we love, they're the things we love. The things where you feel like you're seeing someone's personality, you're getting an inkling into who they are as well as the ride that you're on. So, yeah, it's been wonderful to do.
Can you talk a little bit more about the format? Because you picked The Portmanteau, which is an anthology movie. An anthology kind of series are coming back a little bit now, like they've recommissioned Twilight Zone, Black Mirror. But you don't see the anthology movie maybe as much as you did. Why did you pick that format? Was it so you could try your hand at lots of different type of...
No, it was a very natural thing. I mean, there's a romance to it. And I, as you've already mentioned, Elsewhere with the League of Gentlemen, we were a bit obsessed with it as a form too. And in fact, the very first thing we did as the League, before anything, was a self-produced anthology film called Highgate House of Horror.
I've never seen that.
That we shot. It's an extra on the DVD of the Christmas special.
Which is itself...
Or at least there's an Easter egg of it if you have to dig for it, but it is it is in there. And so, there is something in the form that is peculiarly, a peculiar obsession for me, and not just for me, but it was for Mark Stephen Rees as well. So, and I think there's a real charm to it. There's something of the campfire of it. There's something very, very primal about it. Being told a series of scary stories that's just very, very appealing if you like this kind of material. It's not just us that likes anthology films. We know from the response to this that there's a sizable constituency out there.
And I think there's two sort of factions really for it. The first is British gentlemen of a certain age, of which we are, who grow up with Amicus and...
Because they were always on.
House of Horror. Yeah. And, you had this. It was part of our DNA. But then...
I have to find the DVDs on eBay. That's the difference. Like, they're not always on. Like, growing up, I had to, seek them out.
Yeah.
Well, for us, they were they were staples of late night horror double bills, yeah.
And some of those images from those films, because they were in, the Alan Frank Book of Horror and stuff, I still find scary. The skeleton in the crash helmet.
I mean, one of the reasons is, there's two things. It's Dead of Night as being the original one and the Amicus films. And the reason... I think that both of them are so influential, not just for us, but for other people, is that they both are really well made by intelligent lovers of the genre. Dead of Night had the four best Ealing directors on it, who all went on to have stellar careers, Charles Crichton, Basil Dearden, Cavalcanti, and Robert Hamer. Hamer made Kind Hearts and Coronets, and they all made brilliant films. So they were fantastic filmmakers. They had terrific writers. The people that wrote the script wrote all those Ealing comedies. They were first-class writers. They had brilliant behind-camera people. The DP on Dead of Night was Douglas Slocum, who shot Raiders of the Lost Ark. These were absolute world-class filmmakers. And so that is unusual to have people at that level working on genre material. And weirdly, Amicus, although that they were, they're seen as a kind of exploitative outfit, actually they had a similar approach. They were very, Max Rosenberg was a very, very smart producer. And so he knew that he could get people like Freddie Francis, who was, again, a world-class cinematographer, by saying, do you want to direct this? Because he knew he wanted to direct. And likewise, they were smart of promoting talent. So Kevin Connery did From Beyond the Grave, for example, which was the last of the Amicus anthologies, was a fantastic director. He was a real, real visual stylist. And that's there absolutely throughout. So they looked great. They weren't cheap. They were cheap to make, but they did not look cheap. They're not schlocky.
They're in a really weird world.
And they had A-list casts. Yeah. That other brilliant Amicus innovation of, well, look, we only have to pay him for 5 days and we can put him on the poster.
You can be the trip keeper.
You had Ralph Richardson in a horror movie, which is very unusual.
Knight of the Realm.
So that's a big part of their appeal is just that. They were very well made by very clever people.
And they delivered. That's another really key part. They delivered both as sort of soft horror and as pure entertainment. They're real crowd pleasers at a time when that's what we did in the British film industry.
Yes, that's a big deal.
We made films that people...
That stopped after sort of 78, 79. That just went, that spirit of making commercial British films. It all flipped over into subsidised filmmaking, into art house filmmaking because it suddenly was... The funding model was different. It came from Film 4 and BBC films. And so it was a completely different model making completely different films. But this was the last gasp of that.
And then, the other ones that really affected us when we were growing up, Twilight Zone, the movie, has got some absolutely sensational stuff in it. Again, brilliant, brilliant directors. And Creepshow, of course, which is great fun. But other than that, it's, you know, I'm saying that like they're recent. That's probably, you know, I can't remember what's Creepshow. I mean, they've got to be nearly 30 years old, yeah. haven't they? And
I mean, there have been examples, but none as good as that.
ABC's
a
death.
Where there's a weird thing with them, and I think ABC's is the one that's the closest of working, is that there's a gimmick that really helps it. And the ABC's is great because they're all, you know, 3 minutes long, maybe six at the longest. And there is something interesting about using the A to Z thing. It's a great hook. The others, for me, they don't quite work in the same way because it just becomes a way of, you just feel actually all they're doing is stringing together short films. Whereas those early, you know, particularly Dead of Night, it's that the protagonist's story is the scariest, is the one that and you realise all those other stories are there for a reason. It's not an accident, and it's not just a gimmick, you know.
So there's a Scheherazade nature to the form, which is, you know, hugely appealing and sophisticated, and it's very clever as Dead of Night. And so yeah, you get the thrill of being told the individual stories, but then you get the thrill of the part being more than the whole.
In the Amicus ones,
the whole being more than the part. Sorry,
I watched some of the Amicus ones at the weekend, and you know, some of them were adapted from a lot of Robert Bloch stories and some DC comics, and there is still that kind of like slightly moral fable of like something horrible happens to something terrible.
Oh yeah, that's what
horrible.
We love.
Something horrible happens to something terrible, and some of them are really gruesome as well. Like they kind of ramp it up in Tales of the Crypt, you know, with the heart wrapped up in the lair.
It's wicked.
Like, what kind of depiction? Like, this seems much more kind of spectral as a movie than
gruesome. Well, this is
gruesome.
Closer in spirit to Dead of Night.
Yeah, so is that like a very intentional decision that, even though maybe the portmanteau people associate with Amicus, this is very much more that kind of ethereal, what did I see in the corner of the frame, look again, or what
was
that?
Well, this
was
born, don't forget, you know, and the stage show was born out of Andy ringing me, saying he'd had this idea for a play with three men sat on stools telling ghost stories. And I think it was the ghost stories element that completely hooked me in, because I have a passion for ghost stories. And Dead of Night, you know, in Michael Balkan, in his autobiography, the Iran Ely Studio said, you know, their conception for it was a series of ghost stories. So I think that element, the supernatural element, rather than the kind of the visceral, you know, sort of violent horror element that's present in some of the Amicus films, is definitely informing
hugely
us.
Because we also, you know, we talk a lot about, we think we really, it's a golden age of horror that we're in, and has been for quite some time now. You know, there's not a year goes by that another great horror film doesn't come out that you think, oh, that was terrific, you know, that really delivered. But one of the things that's the hardest thing to achieve, and I say that as someone, we adore the genre, and I've got Fright Fest every year, and I've done for 16 years or however long it is now. And the thing that I really chase each year, and that is harder and harder to find, are the things that scare you. Not the things that gross you out or the things that make you jump, because God knows they're still reasonably hard to do and be inventive with. But those moments that make you go cold, that make you think, fuck, oh my God, you know, and you don't want to look, or you can't, or the temptation to leave the light on at night because of, they're rare. They're rare to find. And they tend to really only live in the world of the supernatural, and the world of the ghosts, when you feel like you know, your world is slightly through the looking glass.
I think it's like my favourite scare in the movie is the one in the Paul White House.
No,
I'm not going to go into specifics, but it's in the Paul White House section where you think you see a thing and then it cuts away, cuts back, and it maybe resolves into something else, and then you start to question yourself. So I've seen it twice now, and it's like, you know, it's a recurring line in the film, the brain sees what it wants to see, and you're like, have I misinterpreted that sensory information? Mm. Or was it something else? And I think you play with that really well throughout the movie.
Thank you.
And is that kind of a weird, like, drawing a connection? Does that in a strange way tap into kind of your magic background?
Oh, completely.
Where like, you're playing with people's perceptions. Yeah. You're suppressing the rational explanation, so you create this effect of the supernatural.
Well, we both love Conjuring. That is the other thing, really. I mean, it was horror films, Dirty Jokes, and Conjuring. I mean, that's it, basically. That's all we've got. and magic's a really amazing thing in the way the brain processes.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. Yeah. And there's a real overlap as well, because that's the other thing, is neither of us are believers in at least the literal supernatural, as in ghosts and what have you. However, we're fascinated by, you know, there's a real overlap between the phenomena and the world of conjuring, because it is about, you know, it exists in the penumbra where of the flaws of perception. You know, because perception is the truth about perception is we think everything's very solid and we've got a very clear idea of what's going on, but it's the complete opposite. It's a sketch that the brain fills in, and you know, anyone who works in professionally in conjuring and magic, stage magic, knows that. Because you know how quite fundamentally how easy it is to fool people, and it's a bit like, it's slightly dangerous knowledge in a way, really.
Well, it is, because it does make you look at just makes you question so much, and it makes, you know, when people, especially when people are telling you their experiences, and you just know you're not even getting half the story, you're not even getting half the story. Yeah, I mean, you're getting what they perceive, you know, literally the brain sees what it wants to see. That's what you've decided that experience was. That's what you've decided that information means. Ergo, that's real. And it's just not true, you know. What's amazing is when that bleeds over into the real world, when we look at things, when we look at how we are manipulated in the, you know, and I'm not being all conspiracy theorist at all, but you look at how it's easier than ever with social media to shift, seismically properly shift how nations can vote, how nations can move, by targeting individuals and changing what their perception of the world is and telling them what they want to hear and making them believe what they want to fundamentally believe. That goes back to fairground fortune tellers. You know, the golden rule of a fairground fortune teller, the saying is, tell the lady what she wants to hear. You know, and it's amazing, because then people are susceptible to anything. But then bringing that back to the film and what we, you know, and our love of magic within that, you know, it's pretty much everything is practical effects within the film. And so any CG and stuff that's used are used to sort of help little bits of removals or augment and stuff here. But that was one of the great joys as well, is you'll see things in the film that are fundamentally magic tricks that you're looking at stuff for quite some time that you perceive as one thing that is not that, and then it's revealed to you that it's, you know, and that's a really,
yeah, it's exciting.
Exciting, yeah. Thing to do, because it also, what we used to say to each other, it's like, it's Buster Keaton filmmaking. I mean, it's so old fashioned, but it's so exciting to play with those things.
Yeah, we just get a buzz out of it, because it's entertaining, and you know, there's a fundamental thing of, we just want to give the audience a really good night out. You know, that's a really satisfying thing to do, to try to do.
The final question is, obviously, that you love this stuff and you've really enjoyed making this movie and you're very proud of it, and it is like excellent. I've seen it twice. Like, would you want to do more of these?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Are there any plans?
As long as I'm not working with him, I'm happy.
Because you have like very varied careers, and you do like individually, you do so much stuff. Like,
yes.
Is this like something you would kind of see as a...
Oh, I'd happily spend the rest of our days doing this. Yeah. It's just you know, it's the most indescribable fun. we can't believe that we've been having this much fun with it for 8 years now.
No.
And,
you know, and literally walking in here, seeing these posters, seeing all the posters on the buses and stuff, it's like, you can't believe it. Mm. You can't believe it. And it won't matter if we go on to make 10 films, we will always feel the same, because it's just it's incredible. How lucky are we that we've got to do this? And this thing that made us friends, that our bookshelves are full of, you know, the idea that, you know, I know that there is a book on ghost stories coming out later in the year that we are featured in. Fucking hell. That's amazing.
It's true, because we're still that 15-year-old.
We're still that thing,
yeah,
you know.
So, you know, I mean, just even just getting a review in Starburst was a, was a thing where we texted each other and then ran each other.
But it should be like that, because what goes hand in hand with that joy is also a feeling of massive responsibility that goes to, you want to serve the thing that you love on every single level, and also you owe it to the people that are going to spend anywhere between 5 and 18 quid going to the pictures, hopefully, to see it. You want them to go out and feel like that was great,
well, I think you did it. Like, oh, genuinely, someone who this falls in like my Venn diagram of interest, like, I think the movie's incredible. So,
thank you.
Well done.
Thank you very much.
Cool. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, lovely.
Well, I, for one, thought that was lovely. And I wasn't even in the bloody room or have heard the recording. But I heard that.
But it was nice.
Afterwards.
It's like me awkwardly ending it.
I heard that you asked for something to be signed and they said they had a poster in their car.
It did. Like, I've done this job like 7 years. I think I've asked for like 2 things signed before because I never do a selfie. And like, the signing thing's weird because it's like, they were working, but I just thought, oh, why not? And I got them to sign a copy of the Pan Book of Horror.
Oh, that's
which is like an old anthology and quite an influential anthology of horror books. And I, when I was like a teenager, I bought like an incomplete collection off eBay. And I have like the first collection in my house. So I brought that in for them to sign. And they thought that was very nice.
You're a cool guy.
Yeah, they were lovely.
Like, I meant that. That sounded sarcastic. You are a cool
guy.
It's
just like, as it probably came across, like, I'm just like, I've been so into their stuff for so many years. Mm. And like, it's just cool that they've been given the opportunity to make the film version of the thing they like.
Mm.
When so many people get to make big budget horror movies that are shite, people like, people who actually know what they're doing got the opportunity, so that's wicked.
Good on them.
Time for a little bit of feedback.
Quick little bit of feedback.
Do you want to go first?
Yeah, I'll go first. So last week we were talking about, well, amongst many things, we accidentally suggested about 3 different like responses for feedback, but one of them was your proudest gaming moments to do with online gaming and being sort of...
It's gone back a few weeks now, yeah.
Oh, no, we did this last week as well. Maybe we've...
Oh, it's pre-date, yeah.
Oh, we've done loads.
About, like, what game you're so good at that you like make it unenjoyable for someone else.
It all works together. So this is from Jack Gox Pierce. I don't know what Gox is. Or maybe it's Gox, like Goku. I don't know. We should have Rory here. But we don't. Hello, guys. I wanted to share one of my proudest moments in video gaming with you. Me and my friends used to spend a lot of time hanging out in my friend's car in a car park, as all teenagers did.
What?
Not sure. Did when no one had their own house or flat yet. Actually, now that you say that, it rings a bell.
Get out of the car.
My friend had a big...
Lean on it.
Had a big Jeep. And we, I once sat in the back of it and ate an entire rotisserie chicken by myself, which would explain a lot of things about me and my size. We would spend countless hours every day taking turns playing Peggle against each other. Sure, Peggle would appear to be a random luck-based game. This is not the case when you're talking Peggle master level. We could call any shot and hit it like the masters we were. And we did this for at least 2 years, maybe more. When it finally came to Xbox, and thus meaning it would be online, me and my friend thought to ourselves, hey, we must be pretty good at this. Let's see how good we are. So, on day one of release, on the hour, we booted the game up and breezed through the campaign to limber up. We clocked it with the number one rank worldwide for the campaign. This got us buzzed. So we hit up competitive and absolutely dominated. We played for the entire day and night and never lost a match, holding the number one rank in the world on 1v1 and party mode, Jesus. Even holding some of the highest scores on individual levels of the campaign just from our first playthrough.
I thought it was just kids sitting in a car.
They're absolute whiz kids sitting in their car. Where was I up to? Needless to say, me and my friend were extremely proud and happy with ourselves. What an amazing feeling it was to think, I reckon we're pretty good at this, to then see that we actually were. I'm sure since then our scores have been eclipsed by far more dedicated hardcore score chasers, but for that moment, we were kings, and I'll never forget that.
That's a weird thing, isn't it? Like, to think you might be good at something, and then later in life just try and go, oh yeah, I am Neymar.
Has that ever happened to you?
No, obviously not. Look at
definitely
me.
Not happened
stay
to me.
Me. Just had 3 mini pork pies.
Mate, you eaten the last...
Yeah, I had another one.
Hey, I've got one more.
In there. That's a good email.
I've really enjoyed that. Gox or Gox. Jack. Whoever the hell you are.
This next email is from Tom Ranking, who is from Manchester.
I like Manchester.
It's a great city.
I watched Gravity there in 3D.
Is that why you like Manchester?
It's the only thing I've ever done in Manchester. That's why I like it.
Good. Listening to last week's podcast caused me to get a bit giddy.
Ooh.
I used to play SOCOM. That's a series you don't hear much about.
We were talking about it because my brother became unfathomably good at it when we were kids.
Disgusting. SOCOM 1, 2, and 3. And they were the first games I remember playing online with that shocking extension on the back of your PS2.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
I was, look at this, just was a little aside here. I was also in the top 50 on Project Gotham Racing 4.
Oh, I thought you were saying you were.
No. Smashed it.
Absolutely.
You absolutely smashed it, Tom.
Is that a Rockstar game, Project Gotham? Or did they do a different racing game? They did one of them.
I think they did, yeah.
I think it was Project Gotham.
Apart from having some awesome... I'm sure if it's not, people will write in.
I'm sure I could literally look on Wikipedia now. Not gonna. Write in.
We're not gonna do that a lot of your other podcasts you might listen to. Apart from having some awesome memories of playing games growing up, he's now 24... No, 27, sorry. What are your worst memories? Mine is having Ali McCoist as a FIFA commentator for far too many years and getting blisters playing the Olympic Games.
Oh, that was bad, the blisters. I got that on Mario Party.
I never got blisters. Do you ever use the Tamagotchi technique?
As in, like, getting your palm on it and then...
Are you literally a Tamagotchi?
Oh, no.
To rub the buttons. Because the Tamagotchi, the weird like gradient on the curve of Tamagotchi, you could like
you
cycle
it up
between
on like
an
track
X and a circle.
Konami track and field.
Yeah.
That's good.
I went through two Tamagotchis like that.
Yeah, I could see that. Dead. Pooping themselves as you did it.
Worst gaming memories.
I think it's not specifically about the gaming itself. The thing that always springs to mind when I think about the horror of being a child was that my dad once bought me Duke Nukem 3D for PS1. And it was for my birthday, and he was going to give it to me. I saw it. I saw the case. I knew what it was. I was really excited, even though that was quite an old game for PS1, I think. But I knew what that game was, and it was exciting.
His reputation is why you wanted
it. Yeah. And then as he passed it to me, he saw the 18 certificate, took it away, put it in a cupboard.
I thought you said he knew what it was.
Put it in a cupboard, didn't give it to me for years, like found it by accident. Once that, like, we were well into PS2.
Mate. I was running around that strip club when I was like 11 on PC.
Like, using the toilets?
I've never even been to a strip club.
No, that's as close as I've ever gone.
I don't know if they're full of aliens or not.
They could be. And in the air ducts, there's like women in weird vats. I hated that. Yeah, in Duke Nukem, there was a really unpleasant thing that like one of the collectibles was there was like women in vats hidden. It was unpleasant. Duke Nukem's not very nice.
No, I think we can all realise that.
Good game, though. Like, as in, literally, the game is good. Have you seen Iron Maiden? So it's the people who made that using the original engine build, making a new game. It looks fucking wicked. Like, really good.
I was really racking my brain's worst gaming memories. My worst gaming memory... isn't to do with the game per se or in a game. I remember when my Xbox 360 got the Red Ring of Death.
Yep, that's bad.
That's bad. But I remember I was midway through Bioshock at the time.
Ooh.
And then I took a bit of regional flavour for you. I took it to the game station in Preston.
Oh, yes, please.
Because fine, because obviously Red Ring of Death was a known thing, a known malady at the time. I took it in game station, boom, boom, new Xbox 360. Get that home.
Red Ring
finish
of Death.
Bioshock. Get home.
You left the disc in the other one.
Disc is in the Xbox 360.
That's disgusting.
And it had already got sent back.
Oh, mate, that's no good. How much did you spend on that? I bet it was full price.
I don't know.
Unbelievable.
So that's my worst gaming memory.
Actually, I've got another one. We had every year my friend had like the same birthday. It became like a weird tradition amongst me and my friends.
We always had the same birthday.
No, but as in like you did the same thing every year. We went to his house, we played games for this long, we had dinner, then we played hide and seek in his garden. It was really good. We were quite young. It was brilliant. And we would always bring games round to play games with, and everyone being like Crash Team Racing or, you know, like party games. And for some reason, being the fucking hipster that I am, I brought around Animal Crossing on the GameCube, being like, guys, you guys check this out. Like, this game's amazing. Because he was. And I brought it around. They were all like, what is this kid's game? Like, ribbed me until I cried and left. I was just like, absolutely not. I'm not having this anymore. That's this is horrible. Disgusting. Yeah, how dare you dislike Animal Crossing?
So thank you for your email, Tom. I would like to put out a new call for feedback. With a slight different emphasis. What are your worst memories that feature video games in some kind of tangential way?
That's a good way to do it. I thought you were going to say, what are your worst memories?
No, that's too big a job for a humble video games podcast like us. But what are your... Basically, just what are some really shitty things that happened to you were video games?
That's a really good question.
Joe just told you one. He went to a party and cried and went home.
Yeah, I did. Luckily, GameCube had the little handle on it, so no one could stop me. unplugged it,
he's
took it away.
Walking home with his little silver GameCube. What colour GameCube?
What silver?
I had the silver.
Got it
one
with
as well.
Wind Waker.
Me too.
Oh, good times. Oh. Good right. memory now.
Thank you for joining us. This was the IGN UK podcast.
And you can email us on IGN_UK feedback@IGN.com.
Anytime you want, because
that's how email works.
None of us got notifications set up for that, so you bother us whenever you like.
Yeah, boy.
And we'll see you next week.
Oh, 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 oh.
What?
One sec. We should thank Zach and Trista.
Oh, we should.
Who got in touch, and we met them, and they were fantastic. And they probably stopped listening because we really got right to the end.
But if you're listening, it's a nice little Easter egg. Much like the film Ready Player One. Nah.
All right, we better
That's
go.
Better than Ready Player One.
Well, they were lovely, and so were you. Good night.
Hey there, it's Rachel Ballinger, and I am extremely excited to invite you to Rachel Uncensored. It's my podcast where I sit down and get real with my friends and celebrity guests, where we talk about all sorts of topics. And sometimes we might be under the influence when we do so. We cover things from personal stories to hot button issues. And it's the only place on the internet you can find an uncensored version of me. It's a side of me that you might not have seen before because it's not the most family or brand friendly. But don't worry, I'm still sort of slightly a decent human being. If you're intrigued, then make sure you check it out. New episodes drop every Wednesday. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Trust me, you won't want to miss out on the fun and candid conversations we have here on Rachel Uncensored.